This program was produced and first aired on Access Manawatu with support from New Zealand On Air.
Community Access Radio. Access Manawatu.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations. Recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
My name is Stuart Burks. We have with us
John
today.
Ward.
Finlay Mason.
Don Esselwant.
Jerry Gordon.
Iola Hegarty.
Okay, and the topic that we're going to be talking about this morning is housing, recollections of housing, how perceptions of housing have changed over time, maybe even differences in style of housing in New Zealand and in other countries. So
we should remember that in Palmerston North we had Ken Tremaine, town planner, who has very well, as a geographer, noted and encouraged recording around the city of the kinds of housing that have occurred at different periods in time. And these are very, very quite considerably from decade to decade, depending on the kind of materials available at the time, the kind of tools available at the time, and styles admired in some cases from overseas like America.
When you say he's recording, where can it be found?
You can see it also on the signposts. The city itself has little leaflets which can tell you about the actual path you can take to see historical sites, which include, for example, a concrete log cabin in Featherston Street, and other sites which really show you the typical house style of a particular period in time.
Well, of course, we had the Californian bungalows, which were 1930s, early 40s, and they were very popular and certainly very well built.
Art Deco. Mm.
You've got everything from the little sort of duplicate rooms at the front of a house leading to two perhaps rooms at the back of the house and maybe a lean-to where or a lavatory out the back. You've starting off in the early days, you've then got, as you work through the period of Victoria, where people start to go for more elaborate verandas on the front around their houses, not necessarily placed in the right places for the Southern Hemisphere, but emulating a particular style, comparable with many sites that you'd see in Australia to keep fend off the heat from that country, going through your 30s with your Art Deco, your 40s with another style, a lot of state housing starting to appear in the 50s, etc., 40s and 50s. And then 60s, we're starting to see the American modern style, and 70s, we're starting to see more Scandinavian style, and then 80s, we're starting to see that whole proliferation from all sorts of areas. So that we see that sequence brought out beautifully in these trails around the city.
Hmm. And there's different materials that are used as well, isn't there? There was the native timbers that were used early on, which proved to be far more durable than people expected. Then there was wood cladding was very common, and stucco as well, wasn't it?
Yes, you find the styles did change with the availability locally of materials, and hence move from the flax and manuka warris into, and then sawn timber became available in great quantities, and greater quantities when powered sawmills were came into stream. And in fact, any wood, you comment on the on the longevity of wood structures which weren't meant to last forever. Any wood, as long as you can keep the moisture away from it, will last almost indefinitely. Then, of course, we had the local brick making became available, so that changed styles somewhat. A use of concrete.
But brick's a problem for New Zealand, isn't it, with the earthquake?
No, as long as it is, its limitations are known, and it's used accordingly. Brick has never been used as a structural medium, or only rarely in this country here. Brick has has been used as a cladding more than anything else. The structure is still the timber frame.
It needs to be tied back to the frame if it's not to fall out.
Interestingly, we when we moved to Palmerston North and with the city council and moved into one of their houses in Manawaroa Street, they, on the other hand, I went to hang pictures and couldn't drive nails into the walls and found that, in fact, they were cavity brick structures throughout, both externally and internally. So that was when brick was used as a structural medium.
Okay. And about what time would that have been built?
Those were built in about 1920s, I think.
Okay. So that before the Napier earthquake?
I would almost think so, yes.
Yeah. Okay. What about the car? I seem to recall they built houses for the road frontage rather than building for the sun. Would that be your experience?
That's occurred through time, but there's also people who've wised up, thank goodness.
Do you think they were comfortable? I mean, ceilings were a lot higher in before, but probably because of wood fires and the smoke, or if it was gas.
I'm not too sure why. We lived in a number of farmhouses, and they universally had a 12-foot stud. I don't know the reasons for that.
Did they feel very cold in winter then?
That's another issue, isn't it? We're hearing a lot about sort of damp, cold houses, and that all our houses of that time were of that type, but it never worried us. You put on another jersey, or you...
But were they damp?
No, they weren't. And they,
There was a ventilation, I think, part of the problem is strong insulation you have.
Exactly, you didn't have condensation because gaps in the old sash window sorts of things, there's a free movement of air. Through them.
And in the really old big houses, you'd have more than one fireplace in rooms. Mm. It'd be not just a fireplace in the lounge, but fireplaces elsewhere as well.
Yeah.
And your wood stove, of course.
Now, I remember some old houses as well that they were prepared for the time before fridges. What was it called? The outside, just an enclosure with some mesh on to stop flies getting in.
A safe.
A meat safe.
A meat safe. And were they effective at, say, stopping milk going sour or meat going?
No, not at all. They were just there to keep the flies out.
Okay.
Any other product just never lasted any longer as a result of that.
Okay. Well, my neighbour actually has a meat safe built into her house because she just so loved them as part of her growing up. And I would like to have a meat safe back in my house, particularly for things like storing vegetables and that, because I find the fridge is not suitable, whereas that open air that comes through, so she stores her butter, her cheese, and all those things there, and it keeps perfectly.
And perceptions have changed as to what is required. Yeah. Meat traditionally was always hung for several days before you. Now we have this view that unless it's come out of the fridge and is stone cold when you put it in the pan, you're going to get some disease.
Oh, but the butchers would treat it first, though, wouldn't they? They'd hang it for a while before.
I'm thinking of growing up on a farm and having home cool.
And you'd hang it then.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah, and
what about the maggots?
If you hang it where
and covered with cheesecloth, things are fine.
Yeah.
But this house, my neighbour's house, is one of three architectural built houses, and it was built in the 70s, and they are all certainly very different to what a standard house would have been in the 70s. But we've got towers, and we've got circular stairways, and we've got hidden rooms and all sorts of things, and it's just makes it much more interesting, I think, when you look at... Yeah. But was it because there was more money around in those days that you could actually have these little bits of folly, we might say, rather than being the practical boxes that were built in the 50s and 60s?
I'm just wondering whether the kind of freedom of thinking that came with the early 70s, the hippie generation, where everything didn't have to be as conventional. And we saw a lot of that kind of change of architecture in the States. It probably came through in things like Ladies' Home Journal and other things which reached our shores, which people would look at and think, ah, yes, and we have some very architects who had lots of independent ideas, including the one down in Wellington who people may don't remember his name off heart.
Atfield?
Could be, yes, Atfield. And if you just think about some of the turret housing along in just on the side of Mount Victoria, his own house, etc., etc.
Well, the library was his joke he played on the city, wasn't it?
Well, whether it was a joke or some people thought it was a good idea.
It was a place that didn't have any lining to all the...
There were noisy...
Are we talking about the Palmerston City Library?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm not quite sure how they could possibly call it a living room of the city when, frankly, it looks like an industrial outfit.
Exactly.
And I really wonder whether that wasn't a PR exercise to avoid spending a lot of money on the library.
But coming back to the change in housing, as with building materials, our particular climate and other conditions dictated the changes that took place. And so when you refer to new ideas coming into the 70s, a number of these things came in without recognising the particular problems. So our driving rain, for instance, and therefore some of the roof types of designs just weren't up to protecting our...
Oh, you mean the flat roof? There was a period when they did a lot of flat roof construction.
There were flat roofs in the 30s too, I think, in the Art Deco
period.
Devastating in the 30s. Our house was built in 37. It was Art Deco, with rounded corners and all that sort of thing, all fashioned in wood, but all clad with concrete.
Yes.
And had they stopped the water, they had little cappings over the top of the walls, the water driving up underneath them. And of course, concrete cracks. And you get masses of water down where the cracks are. And we have this wood just rotting. When they took the cladding off our house, 25 years after it was built, I recladded it. I couldn't believe the damage to the wood on the walls.
So the leaky buildings issue that's been a major concern recently is actually just a continuation of it's different materials that caused it probably, but the continuation of old problems that they've had for a long time.
Yeah.
Well, we've got even greater problems occurring with that currently with the climate change giving us 1 in 100 year returns every 2 or 3 years. I'm noticing it myself. I have a flat roof in the area in which I live, and the water's just coming straight off it like a fire hose. You know, it just can't cope with the volume of downpours we're getting these days. So I'm just going to have to adjust all the piping and that goes around that to cope.
It's what used to drop down and through the ceiling. We had a centre gutter. And I'll never ever buy a flat roof house like that ever again. It was a butterfly.
Yeah. One thing that a lot of the maybe 100 year ago houses had or earlier was a veranda going round a large part of the house. Now, we don't see that now. You see a bit with decks, but not necessarily covered. But was there a particular advantage or disadvantage with the veranda? Is it just costly so they haven't done it anymore? Or I could imagine it helping keep the places cool in summer.
Good for keeping the kids out and playing on the veranda.
Okay, yeah.
Rather than messing the house up.
I think our climate determined that to some extent. Very typical in Australia, isn't it? So with our sort of summers, anyhow, that's what they were put in place for.
So why the change? That's what I'm wondering.
Because it was as expensive, I dare say, to put a veranda up as an additional room, and it's just one of those economy measures.
But if you also think about the fact that in the 19th century, the idea of white skin and keeping it for women, their hands, they used to wear gloves and hats to try and make sure that their complexions didn't get turned tanned, which became a fad in the 1970s, for example. And so if you have verandas, you can sit outside, but you also can keep your complexion looking gorgeous. If you think about the 70s, it's just the reverse. You've got to try and get out there and get brown as quickly and covering as much of the body as you possibly can. It's a difference in approach. If you think about the clothing of the change between that period, it's just amazing.
I never thought of it in that direction, though.
Well, I once lived in a double-story house with verandas, around the top as well as
and
so it just for me I think it was maybe something that translated through from days when people had a lot of money in the gold rush or whatever, because that was roughly when the house I was living at the time was built. Who knows? I don't know, but there's an excellent program that has occurred as a series and been broadcast recently as a series on New Zealand television, looking at housing styles through time, and it's definitely worth going to explore that one to get much more detailed information and excellent visual examples of the changes through time and the reasons for them.
Because they do talk about the fact that the early colonials did not take notice of what foray building was about, and how really well insulated they were, and the design was to make it a comfortable space to be in.
And the insulation was partly because they were underground?
Well, yes, and it was the roof style, but the way the water ran off, and it was a much better building to live in a foray in our climate than it was when they started to build colonial style houses.
And the materials went a long way. Materials of construction went a long way towards providing that, didn't they?
But he was saying that should they have taken notice of what how it was built, and then translated that into the European style of housing, that they would have been much more comfortable houses to live in. So
how did Faroe survive in... flooding's an issue for several years.
They didn't build right down on the stream bed.
Yes.
They built it on the top of the
river. Well, I don't know. The river today is in flood... Stuart, so we might...
It's in flood, is it? Is
yes, we might learn something today.
Oh, I'll have to go have a look. Well, yeah, you're very close to that.
Yes.
I could be wrong, but I believe there's a planning case that occurred under New Zealand's planning laws prior to the RMA coming in, the Resource Management Act, and under which it was decided by a particular judge, if I'm not mistaken, in the Canterbury area, which... meant that from there on in, councils did not have the same ability to deny people building on floodplains or near the coast in a way that they had been denied previously for safety reasons. And I think quite a lot of what is now afoot in New Zealand and a concern and will be very costly to change is the outcome of that particular decision.
Well, it's almost like buyer beware. You need to do your homework before you decide where it's going to be. I was interested to hear about the land that's being developed for housing by the lagoon on the other side where the university...
Oh, yes, where the teachers' college used to be.
Yes, the teachers' college was there. So part of the process in thinking about building there was that it's actually on liquefaction. There's going to be a serious problem. Now, we want to build there... $1 million-plus homes, and so we want to make it attractive. But there certainly is this question of liquefaction, and how is the council going to get around that in order to make it in a desirable place to be?
Well, that's interesting. It was only very recently with the Christchurch earthquake that, despite all the history of earthquakes in New Zealand, that even New Zealanders became aware of liquefaction being a possible problem.
It's actually there before, because I recall very, very clearly one of the very earliest New Zealand databases of actual research material put together, and this was done by Dr. Jaspers, and in that was a report which I've never forgotten about where liquefaction might occur in New Zealand. And at the time I had a question mark in my mind about it, and that question mark has been fully answered by what's happened since. So that was put out in about 1981, if I'm not mistaken. So there was a consciousness, and it was certainly available
in
there amongst
the geologists. Specialist consciousness, probably, but not,
what I want to bring
general.
Up in relationship to that is if we're anticipating a potential mega thrust of the Pacific plate in relationship to the Australian plate off the Hikarangi Trench area on the east coast of New Zealand, and the impacts that that will have, and if we think about the fact that the council is here in Palmerston North is currently being advised by a newcomer to New Zealand who is suggesting that we should revert to the old water flow patterns of the of the rivers and not have straightened areas as we have had over time more recently. You have to think about that area down near the area you were just speaking about near the golf club, because that is actually an area which in the past has been flooded. It's in one of the lowest lying areas. What if we get this, the effect of a very big earthquake, which is going to unsettle ground distinctly in within a some kilometres of that Ruahine and Tararua areas? Who knows what's going to happen in terms of the flows which occur, what might happen to any kind of river patterns that might change on this side in consequence? We don't know. And it certainly was likely to affect the riverbank protections that have been put up there. I wouldn't personally like to be buying in that area which is proposed for development on that former Okawhiti campus.
Mind you, bear in mind, the flooding you speak of happened before the current stock banking has put in place.
But the stock banking was made up, isn't it, of gravel and earth, so there's no reason why that shouldn't shake in an earthquake.
But in point of fact, the river, we can see, has receded from virtually the terrace of Church Street right back to its present location. And the area that's up for development now, the subsoil there is no different, really, from the soils from Ferguson Street right back to the river. All of that area is the same silty material left by the retreat of the river and the floods that occurred, and it's all silt through there.
Well, the council have got liquefaction areas plans on there, very difficult to read without magnification. However, it does show that most of Palmerston North would be subject to liquefaction. And I spoke to an engineer, which we got from come up from Christchurch, and he said there are things that people can actually do to support their houses so that, you know, sewerage and your water and things still happen, which they've learned from their experiences in Christchurch. And it seems to me that, you know, we really should not be just turning a blind eye to it. But it was,
so is that flexible piping and
Yeah, actually having them tied up to your house, having it firm.
Oh.
The piping's flexible, how but it needs to be
above ground?
Under your floor, but you know,
have the connections secure so they won't come adrift.
So there were all sorts of things that he talked about you know, how we could, because that for me was more important than talking about earthquake damage to buildings in the CBD and all these sorts of things. I actually want to know, what is it that the ordinary householder can do to protect their property? Rather than
because that's what they found, infrastructure vulnerability, or the house could be undamaged but the section is no longer viable.
That's right.
Or the roads have been.
And of course his argument also was that actually houses are not really worth a lot of money at all. It's your land and your land stability, and those are the things that you should be investing in, making sure that if we do have the major earthquake like we think, that it has still got value, because your house probably won't have value at all.
So connecting up the pipes more securely won't actually be beneficial.
But it'll mean that the house probably is all going to be in
one unit.
Keeping it in one unit.
If you have a concrete structure, as they did round our place, a 2 metre by 2 metre concrete bunker, as it were.
Yes.
Filled solid concrete for the house to sit on before we could add extra rooms up the top. But gee, what a difference does it make to an earthquake? Does that concrete break apart?
Crack quite likely.
It'll probably crack, but
2 metres by 2 metres is quite thick, isn't it?
Mm.
He was a really interesting gentleman. We called a public meeting for him to talk to the public, and we actually paid for it ourselves. And we got 50 people came along.
Now, they did say, though, that one of the major risks, at least the risk to life with earthquakes, were the brick chimneys falling down.
Yes,
but they were there for a long time. Why is it that earthquakes are an issue now, but it wasn't when these
I think it's the magnitude of the earthquake. This is very much a feature of the older houses in Christchurch, chimneys falling. And I think it's just the magnitude of the earthquake that has brought this about. We've always lived, and the chimneys have stood in the minor shakes that we experience throughout the year here.
Yeah.
Well, people learned lessons, really, essentially, from the Napier earthquake about chimneys. That knowledge has been around for a long time.
Yeah.
But the Christchurch issue is that a lot of places were built on really what is unsolid ground. It's rather like Mexico City. There's a lot of ex-swamp ground that's been filled in to a degree.
And the particular nature of the earthquake as well.
But Christchurch was thought to be a place where earthquakes didn't happen.
Yeah.
Because no fault lines have been identified at that stage.
Nonetheless, they've still been anticipated by the EQC, particularly, and they're particularly concerned in the event of any major shift on the Southern Alps. They've been very, very aware that that could affect impact Christchurch quite considerably.
Coming back, though, to your point about liquefaction areas in Palmerston North, I've got to disagree that a lot of the city is subject to this. That area above from Church Street back is all on very highly cemented gravels there, and there's just no possibility for the central area to be subject to that sort of thing. As you move back out into the course of the Mangone Stream, again you get the low-lying areas there, but it's not true to say that a large portion of the Palmerston North City is subject to that.
Well, certainly on the map that they produced, it did look like
gravels.
Trenches throughout the most of Palmerston North.
I think it would be interesting to actually, you know, have a look at what that map is and just see how reliable it could be. Obviously, you've got more skills than that area.
Well, maybe sometime in the future people will be listening to us and thinking, how much did they know about what was going on? Well, maybe they'll all be proved wrong.
Just go and have a look at the liquefaction report on the Palmerston North City Council site.
Okay.
It will tell you a lot about things, including the gravels.
Okay, and that's giving you the last word, Cherry, because we're over time now, but thanks very much. Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can be found on the Access Manawatu website. A range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive, and the address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Access Manawatu is a non-profit radio station.
We exist to help people from Manawatu make programs just like this one.
All of our shows are free to listen to and free to make.
If you like what you hear and you'd like to help us make more,
you can donate through our website.
Go to www.accessmanawatu.co.nz and click on the donate link on the front page to help us keep on giving people their fair share of the air.